Well, thank you very much, Steve, for your kind introduction. It's a pleasure to address the ABE again. I've lost count of how many speeches I've given here. I'm sorry I missed Ross's lecture. Might have learned something. I'd also like to acknowledge the support the ABE gives to the Unica Foundation. Very strong support in some of the functions that we run, greatly appreciated. Thank you for that. It was to the ABE that in October 2006 I gave my first speech as governor. Tonight's the 23rd speech. In between, as Steve said, quite a lot has changed globally and domestically, though I doubt the speeches have become any more exciting. Many people have said to me recently that the times are interesting, by which I think they mean in the sense of the Chinese curse, and my response to that is maybe they're a little too interesting, and I hope for boring soon. I need not remind you here, of course, of the turmoil through which we've lived for the best part of a year and a half now, nor of the particular intensity of the events since middle of September this year. I don't know anyone who predicted that course of events, and that ought to cause us to reflect on just how hard a job forecasting is. What we've seen is truly a tail outcome in the distribution of events, the kind of outcome that the routine forecasting process never predicts. But it's occurred and it has implications, and so it behoves us to think about those and reflect on it. And so in that spirit, what I propose to do is set out a few features of the episode that I think make it interesting, quote unquote. The most obvious one, of course, is the prominence of financial events and particularly financial sector impairment in key countries. There have been other episodes where individual financial institutions or sectors or even the whole banking system of small countries have needed recapitalisation. But on this occasion, the scale of the capital needed, the number of countries where it's needed, and the extent of counterparty risk aversion because of concerns over solvency have been outside the range of experience of the past half century at least. In the near term, of course, the financial stress brings the obvious concern about the ability, or lack of it, of the financial system to provide credit to the economies in question. As one measure of that concern, and only one statistic, the number of loans approved for housing in the United Kingdom in October was 65% lower than a year earlier, and about 50% lower than the low point reached in the downturn in the early 1990s. So pretty serious. The immediate need then, and this is not original, of course, is to keep ample liquidity, to strengthen banks' balance sheets by adding capital, and to add confidence where needed, including by lending the strength of the sovereign's credit rating. So liquidity, capital and confidence, as we've said before, and all of that's happening in the relevant countries. What might still be needed internationally is ongoing attention to the remaining problem assets, if they remain on bank balance sheets, since if their prices continue to decline, then the capital position of the banks continues to be impaired. So while the UK solution has emphasised new capital, the US solution initially emphasised excising the problem assets off the balance sheets, the Swiss solution has actually been to do both, to recapitalise but also remove the bad assets from the balance sheet of the bank in question so that their balance sheet is cleaned up. And that looks like quite an effective technique. Continued efforts to improve and provide clarity on the state of balance sheets also is important. Surely the lingering counterparty risk aversion that we see reflects at least in part uncertainty on that score. longer term, some of the implications of the past year's events will be seen in the regulatory environment. In those countries where the public purse has needed to be used in order to assure bank solvency, it can be expected that there will be significant regulatory reform, and rightly so. How could it be otherwise? The real trick, however, will be to make sure that the reforms are not just a knee-jerk reaction to the symptoms of financial excess, as clear as they are, but well-considered, durable and tractable changes that appropriately contain but do not crush the financial sector's capacity and appetite to take risk. Certainly over the past five or so years, too much risk was taken, and risk of the wrong sort. The danger in the next several years, however, won't be too much risk-taking, but too little. And so regulators will want to avoid compounding that problem. While the prominence of financial events has been clear, there's also been a set of interesting, quote-unquote, events in the real economy unfolding at the same time. The fortunes of the Chinese economy, as we know, are increasingly important, particularly for Australia and for other countries in this time zone. I think the most striking economic fact of the past several months is not the continued US economic weakness, but that China's economy has slowed much more quickly than anybody had forecast. Our own estimates suggest that Chinese industrial production probably declined, didn't just slow down, actually declined over the 4 months to October. Some of that may be attributable to the Olympic effects, but surely not that much. Some of it reflects the weakening in Chinese exports to the major countries. But I suspect more than that has been occurring. I'm not sure that many economic forecasters have fully appreciated this yet. There's every chance, I think, that the rate of growth of China's GDP is currently noticeably below the 8% or so pace that's embodied in many forecasts for 2009. The Chinese authorities, having sought a slowing of their economy to counter evident overheating, are now moving policies quickly in an expansionary direction. So there's a good chance that China's economy will look stronger in a year's time than it does now. It's important, though, that that's done in the right way. That is, by boosting domestic demand. China's slowing recently may be part of a third striking or interesting fact, namely the simultaneity of the weakening in economic activity around the world over recent months. When that occurs, one is naturally led to look for a common shock. The noticeable slowing in many economies in the June quarter seemed at the time to be attributable to the sharp run-up in oil prices, which went from about $90 or $100 in March to nearly $150 by about July, as you know. Well, that rise has now been more than reversed, but the slowing, if anything, has intensified during the past several months. The more recent weakening might be the result of more widespread and intense tightening of credit conditions, and that clearly has occurred in some of the major countries. But the state of domestic financial sectors differs across countries. In Australia or Japan or much of East Asia or Canada, the banking system is in much better shape than in the UK or the US or Europe. One thing that does stand out as closely related across countries, however, is the fall in share markets. Those, of course, are to some extent themselves a reflection of weaker expected economic outcomes over the period ahead. But with closely linked financial markets and rapid communication, changes in sentiment are transmitted very quickly across countries, and it appears, at least to me, that those changes in sentiment are themselves affecting behaviour. People, both households and firms, understandably have become much more uncertain about the outlook, having seen all the financial turmoil and the share price falls, and correspondingly are more cautious in their own behaviour. So in essence, we're now in a period where the essential nature of events is not so much a financial crisis It is a crisis of confidence on the part of households and businesses, and it's global in nature. Hence the need for actions that are internationally consistent and decisive to address that situation. On that score, a fourth interesting feature of this episode, I think, has been the speed with which official institutions appear to be reacting to the economic fallout that is now unfolding. To take just one example, IMF forecasts and associated policy advice are being revised more often and faster than I can recall in the past. Now, maybe that's because there's so many more international meetings today and they get asked their opinion more often, and that's certainly true. But my sense is that international official bodies and their domestic counterparts are shifting their assessments unusually quickly as they attempt to grapple with the situation. Monetary policy, of course, as Steve said, has been eased quite aggressively around the world. There's a fair bit of fiscal policy easing in prospect as well. In fact, one of the striking features to me of the recent round of G20 meetings was the way the need for fiscal stimulus, where debt levels permit, was readily agreed between participants and was encouraged by the IMF. I don't think I've heard that before. Of course, agreeing to things at a meeting is the first step, and it's the easiest step. Actual policies have to be delivered, and they have to be done in a timely and effective way, and hopefully in a consistent way across countries. I use the word consistent because it seems to me it's better for policies to be broadly consistent and timely than for them to be perfectly coordinated but delayed. So, in addition to that, you've got to calibrate what's done for the circumstances you face, and that's no easy matter. Nonetheless, it seems to me that all of this is happening on an accelerated timetable compared with previous occasions. Now, it wouldn't be realistic to suggest that that response has been, or ever could be, so fast, so well targeted, that significant near-term weakness in the global economy can be avoided. In fact, the data coming in by the day confirm there is an international downturn taking place, and that it shows every sign of being a deeper one than the rather shallow affair of 2001. The question then is whether we have reasonable grounds to expect that the combination of private and public efforts to address the financial problems, the subsidence of sheer panic in financial markets, and that has subsided a little bit, and the use of macroeconomic policy to provide stimulus to weak economies will establish sound foundations for a return to sustainable growth sometime during 2009. Well, we don't know yet. It seems to me, though, that the inauguration of the new US administration is a key opportunity. The economic downturn has been deepening quickly during the transition period. But if the new team can announce credible plans to accommodate the necessary adjustments in the US economy, then confidence in medium-term prospects can be rebuilt, and that, of course, would help the US but also help the situation elsewhere. Thinking beyond that to the next expansion internationally, well, no doubt it will have some different characteristics to the previous one. For one thing, it can't be based on a continual gearing up by households in the developed world and associated asset price escalation. For that reason, neither can it be characterised by the continued large build-up of balance of payments surpluses in the emerging world. The secular increase in living standards in those countries ought to play a bigger role in driving global demand in the future. That, of course, will depend on appropriate policies in those countries and in the developed world as well. It looks like there will be a fairly prominent role, at least in the near term, for governments in many advanced countries through the recapitalisation and/or guarantees of banks or fiscal expansion or both. But for sustained growth, of course, there will also need to be a role for innovation and prudent risk-taking in the private sector, even though at present that is in retreat. Well, turning closer to home, the Australian economy has seen a significant change in circumstances over the past 6 months. The biggest terms of trade boom in half a century is over, and it's in the process of partly unwinding. I still think that China's emergence is far from complete, and that as a result, the terms of trade will be higher on average in the future than they were until a few years ago. But over the next year, they will be down from their peak, probably quite noticeably. Our households, like those elsewhere in the world, have observed financial turmoil and a decline in share prices and have become more cautious. Consumer spending, which slowed significantly in the period from February to about June as interest rates rose and petrol prices rose very sharply, has remained slow since, even though interest rates have declined quite significantly and so have petrol prices. I think we can expect that households will be more cautious about debt in particular for the next couple of years. Business investment and government spending, of course, have remained strong thus far, and for that reason domestic demand in the latest data was 4% higher than a year earlier. But businesses are currently in the process of scaling back investment plans and hiring intentions. That's partly in response to the slower consumer demand, but the dramatic change of view about international conditions and the general uncertainty reflected in financial market prices are surely playing a major role there. So for the period ahead, private demand at least could look weaker than it has for some years. What then do we need to do to ensure, as far as we can, that that period of weakness is pretty brief and that prospects for longer-term sustainable growth are maintained? Well, we can't change the course of the world economy, of course, but we can keep our own house in order so as to maximise our chances of good performance. And on that score, as I've said before, Australia has scope to use macroeconomic policy to support the economy in the weak part of the cycle. That scope was earned by being prepared to run budget surpluses and run down debt when revenues were strong, and by raising interest rates to contain inflation when the economy overheated. The scope to ease policies is now being used. On the fiscal side, the automatic stabilisers, so-called, will reduce the budget surplus as the economy weakens. That's what they're designed to do. There's also, as you know, been a front-loaded discretionary easing of a spending kind that's arriving in recipients' bank accounts this week. Of course, a good deal of that may be saved, but even if it is, presumably that takes the place of private saving that would otherwise have occurred over a longer period. So it seems to me that it brings forward the point at which households become confident enough to lift their spending. Also on the fiscal front, and I've said this before, there's no reason why worthwhile public investment decisions that are currently planned should not proceed, provided they really are worthwhile. On the monetary front, interest rates right across the spectrum have fallen. Some fairly elementary calculations suggest that as a result of the decline in rates that we've already had, the fall in the household sector's gross debt servicing burden will be almost 3% of aggregate household income. That is roughly equal to what was seen in the early 1990s when the cash rate fell from 18% to 4.75%. But on that occasion, it took 2.5 years. This time, it's taking place over 4 or 5 months. The decline in borrowing costs, admittedly for businesses, has generally been a bit slower to occur, but there has been faster pass-through of the most recent reduction in the cash rate in that area. These transmission channels of monetary policy then are still working in Australia, unlike the case in some other countries where, to take the US case, the Fed cut the Fed funds rate to the bone, but until quite recently, the rates actually paid by mortgage borrowers didn't fall at all over the past year. In addition, the exchange rate is playing its normal role of adjusting to changed circumstances in a way which stabilised the economy. It's declined by about 25% in trade-weighted terms since the middle of the year, and that's just about the largest movement we've had since it floated in such a short period. So they're quite big changes. They, of course, will take time to have their full effect, but they will be making a significant difference to conditions over the year ahead. There is scope to do more with macroeconomic policy settings if needed, given the strength of the public accounts at federal level and the outlook for declining inflation so far as monetary policy is concerned. In assessing whether more is needed, and if so, how much, we will naturally need to watch the data closely, but we'll also need to remember the extent of stimulus which is already in the pipeline as a result of past actions. Other supportive factors include the state of the financial system. I know I've said this many times, but it does bear repeating. Of course, credit conditions for some sectors, notably property, have tightened. And overall credit to business is rising much more slowly than the 20% plus rates of a year ago. But even so, over the 3 months to October, credit provided by intermediaries rose at an annualised pace of about 12 to 13%. On a broader definition, which includes capital market raisings, the pace was about 9% over that period. Both those numbers are actually a little higher than they were in the middle of the year. In most developed countries, that would be considered a very satisfactory pace of credit growth, if not a little on the high side. Credit growth to households, of course, has been very slow by historical standards, running at 4 or 5% recently. Margin loans in particular are contracting very quickly, 30 or 40% a year, as people reduce their leverage. Lending for housing, I think, though, now is starting to pick up from the early impact of the interest rate reductions we've had. Australian banks, having raised very large quantities of deposits in the past couple of months, the money supply fans among you, go check those numbers out, are now turning back to offshore markets, making use of the government guarantee. They don't seem to have had much trouble, as we saw even today, raising capital from private markets when they needed it or wanted it. So overall, this situation, while not without its difficulties, is far better than the one we see in some other key countries. So they are key elements of handling the cyclical episode that we confront. Longer term, of course, performance will depend on the things that it always has depended on, which principally isn't macroeconomic policy. It's the quality of investment, public and private, productivity increasing, innovation and reform, getting the balance right on regulation. All that's very hard. But at various times over the past couple of decades, Australia has made considerable progress in those areas, and it has a pretty good record of responding to the need for change, particularly in times of adversity. There's no reason we shouldn't maintain that record. So, as I said at the outset, we are indeed living through interesting times. They're tough times for businesses, for households, for financial markets, and for policymakers. Given the global situation, we have a very difficult period to negotiate, but we can negotiate it. The long-run prospects for the Australian economy, as I said a few weeks ago, have not deteriorated to the extent that people might be feeling right now. We do have reasonable grounds for some quiet confidence in the future, however bad the storm may be just now. A period of reflection and recharging of batteries over the break will be helpful. I think, to be honest, one of the problems in the world is there are too many people in financial markets who haven't slept much for a year and a half, and you need a break. So at the conclusion of a hectic year, I wish all of you a Merry Christmas and a much less interesting 2009. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Glenn. Another excellent speech. We very much appreciate it. Of course, Glenn's agreed to take some questions. Can you please state your name and your affiliation and keep the questions short and to the point, no mini speeches, and Glenn will answer those as he sees fit. So it's a bit difficult to see, but...
Or not.
Yeah, or not.
I think there's a couple at the back up there.
Let's go over here first.
All right.
Is there a microphone? Microphone coming. Hang on, there's a mic. Oh, come on. Oh, sorry, I should say there's mics at the front here and over there. Yeah, thank you.
I heard you touch on the government guarantee, and today we've seen Macquarie fail to get funding and ANZ have got minimal funding overseas, and the bill's oil margin continues to blow out. The government guarantee seems to have failed. Where do we move to next? What's the next?
Well, I don't think you can draw that conclusion just yet. I mean, the bill spread to OIS goes up and down quite a bit. It's going up just now, but that fluctuates. The international markets, I think, have got a bit of indigestion from the huge amount of issuance there's been from a number of sources seeking to use the guarantee of the government in question. So I don't think we know yet how that will turn out. I would be confident that the quality of these banks and the quality of the guarantee they'll be using will see them get adequate funding before too long.
Michael Knott, Sabine Amro Morgans. My question is to I think it was the second paragraph of your speech where you talked about the Swiss banking plan. And you said that what was interesting, the way the Swiss destroy bad assets. So please tell us, how did the Swiss destroy bad assets? Or take up bad assets?
I'm sorry, what's the...
You were talking about the Swiss banking plan.
Yeah.
And how they take bad assets off the market.
Yeah. So how did they do it?
Yes, how did they do it?
Well, they set up a vehicle. UBS put the assets into the vehicle. There was some funding from the central bank. UBS remained exposed to some of the risk. The central bank or the government, I forget which, got an equity stake in UBS at the same time. So there's new capital resources, but the bad assets get quarantined. So I'm making the point that that combination, I would think, is probably pretty effective, as opposed to doing just one or the other. That's my memory of that episode anyway.
Mike Thomas, Access Economics. Alan Greenspan used Robert Shiller's line about irrational exuberance back in 95 or 96 to describe US stock markets. Central banks have done a lot of work on how to incorporate financial market prices and asset prices into the monetary policy framework. Mm. Ian Harper touched on it this morning, and there seems to be a consensus that that's the way forward in the future. What would the RBA do to incorporate financial asset prices, et cetera, into the monetary policy framework?
This is a very big topic. I'll give my sermon on it now since you raise it. This has been a very long-running debate, right? And we've been thinking about this since at least the Japanese bubble economy period back in the early 90s. I think it's fair to say that the international debate heated up quite a bit after the dot-com bust. And there was then a discussion of should the Fed have in fact followed through on the irrational exuberance comment and done more to lean into that bubble or not. And my feeling at the time was, well, the way that question ultimately gets answered will depend on how successful they are in restarting growth in the US economy. If they're not that successful, if they find it hard, then the people who want to lean into the asset swing are going to get more traction. But of course, what happened was they got growth going again just fine. That was a very shallow recession. Growth restarted pretty quickly. And the people who were keen on more action on asset prices didn't get traction. Now, some of the critics would say that they got growth going at the cost of starting another bubble. Maybe, maybe not. But that's how that debate played out at the time. So now we have another observation in this time series of asset booms and busts. And I guess my sense is that if they struggle to get growth going this time, which they may well, then there'll be a change of thinking here. The Fed, at least some of the people in the Fed that I know, are still, I think, not that convinced that they can do much about asset bubbles. In principle, should you do something, and in practice, can you? They're separate questions, and you might answer yes to the first but no to the second, and I think some of the Fed people probably give that answer. So the debate is heating up again now, and it'll be interesting to see how that pans out. I would not underestimate, speaking as someone who writes a lot of monetary policy press releases, writing one every month, in fact, these days, don't underestimate the presentational difficulties of saying everything's fine, but we think house prices are too high, so we're raising rates to head off a problem that's going to happen in 5 years, because that's what you're talking about. It could be the ideal policy, but it would require extensive education.
Chris. It's Chris Caton from BT Financial Group. First of all, Glenn, thank you very much for your words of wisdom. This is your 23rd speech. I'm not sure, I may have missed it, but I'm not sure I heard the word inflation, much less the evil twin deflation. You raised your inflation forecast in the last statement from memory. I guess my first little question is, do you regret doing that? And my bigger question is, should we be concerned about either inflation or deflation in the year ahead?
Well, I did mention inflation briefly. Sorry you missed it, but I'll send you the highlighted text tomorrow. Do I regret the forecast? Well, the forecast is made on the day based on what you know then. And, of course, careful readers will know that there's a discussion of risks and uncertainties and so on. The main reason it was raised, it's really a shifting out of the profile of the reduction because the exchange rate's fallen 25%. Of course, it could be that there's enough disinflation or even deflation in the world economy that won't be in net terms inflationary for us. Should we fear deflation? Well, one of the speeches I gave to the ABE some years ago was about deflation back in 2002 or 3, when I thought that there was too much worry about it at that time. I don't think one could dismiss it quite so easily today, but it still seems to me that it's a bit of a stretch to assert that the major economies will fall into the serious kind of deflationary trap that you can't get out of. That's a different thing to having a temporary period of falling prices that persists only for a little while. Indeed, prices are falling now because of the decline in energy that's been incredibly steep. But does that presage a deflation trap? Well, I think that's a much bigger question, and I wouldn't conclude myself that the answer is yes.
Governor Stevens, Rory Robertson, Macquarie Group. Last year I asked dinner speaker a tough question and almost got banned, so I'll try and serve you up a Dorothy Dixer tonight. Here goes.
Why are you doing such a great job, Governor, or something like that? Not that much, Dorothy.
Okay. I'll get a different one. The big home price falls in the US and the UK have helped poison their banking systems and their economies. Yeah. My question is, will that happen here? Do you find plausible the very high profile forecasts of 30 or 40% drops in Australian average home prices?
It's another way of asking, do I want to join you on the walk? If it happens. I think that probably won't happen. House prices have declined a bit just lately, though some of the very preliminary monthly data for the past month or two suggest stabilisation. That's a bit preliminary, though. But as someone wrote, we haven't got serious overbuilding. In fact, we've got underbuilding. I don't think we have some of the dynamics that are at work in those other places. I think there are some quite serious questions, though, about why house prices have to be so high in a country with this much land and this few people. But they're long-run structural questions, so I think the answer to your question is no, it seems to me unlikely. So you can, I think, rest easy. Bill. Is that reassuring enough, Rory?
Bill Evans from Westpac, Governor. Governor, I'd like you to cast your mind back to 2003. You referred to a speech you made at the time about deflation. I think we all accept now that Chairman Greenspan made a big mistake in pushing interest rates too low, but also made a big mistake in leaving them too low for too long, and then made the third mistake in not taking it back in bigger lumps and 25 basis points. Would you believe that the big mistake was going as low as 1%, or do you believe the fundamental mistake was waiting around too long before you took it back?
Well, I hesitate to point out the mistakes or otherwise of others. It's probably not a safe thing to do. But let me make one point. I did feel at the time that the risk of deflation was not as high as many people had said. The bond market seemed to be saying it was very real. The equity market said no, and the equity market at that time was right. But there's another point to make here, and that is it's about those long-term yields. The Fed doesn't set the Treasury bond rate. The capital market sets that. And if rates were too low for too long, it's just as much those rates were too low for too long. And that helped, I think, spark the search for yield. As we've said before, given long enough, the search for yield gets into some very exotic territory if it goes for long enough. And that was a function as much of long rates as short rates. So the question is, why were the long rates that low? And I think that those people who say that that has something to do with excess of saving over investment in Asia, that flows into the world markets, it bids down the marginal price of capital, the capital goes to the country or countries where people are most responsive to that price change, and that would be typically English-speaking countries, including the US. Now, I think that story has got a lot of veracity. So even if you think the Fed may have kept the short rate too low for too long, I don't think that explains why the long rates were so low for so long, and I think that was an important part of the dynamic. I mean, you know, a lot of US housing lending, as you know, is keyed off the long rate, not the short rate. So I think that's an important part of the story.
But you don't think that if they'd moved earlier, the long rates would have moved more quickly?
Well, who knows? I mean, at the time, my recollection is that they were worried about the long rate going up too much once they started to tighten, as had happened in the mid-90s. And so we had the language about, you know, the measured pace and all that stuff. They were actually almost too successful in containing the pressure on long yields. It could be that their own credibility was purely the answer, the reason for that, but I think those other dynamics also were at work. One more? Okay. Hey, Bruce.
Bruce Hockman from the ABS. 10 years ago, Paul Krugman referred to the Australian economy as the miracle economy in the midst of the Asian crisis. Are there any lessons for forecasters of the Australian economy now, between now and that period?
Well, I suppose one lesson from then was don't write it off too soon, because that we managed to negotiate that period quite well. That said, this is not a regional event, it's a global event, so it's not so easy to escape as maybe it was on that occasion. But I think one of the things that worked well on that occasion was we had good policy frameworks. We let the exchange rate do its work. We kept our eye on the medium-term outlook for inflation. You know, kept the system that's worked well intact and running, and certainly we should do that in this period, and that will be better than kind of, you know, the alternative. But this is a bigger episode, I think there's no question. Jessica.
Jessica Irvine from the Sydney Morning Herald.
Fresh
Governor, I'm just wondering any holidays planned for the festive season, and in particular where you plan to be on the first Tuesday in January. Is there any chance that you'll be chairing a board meeting?
I'm actually planning to be... I will not be at the office, but I won't be far from the office. but no meeting has been scheduled at this time.
Leaving open the option?
Well, in truth, the option is open any month to do something intermeeting if there's a big enough event to cause it. And that's no less true now. But I also think that a lot's been done in a short period. The flow of data does actually slow down a bit in early January. And for reasons like that, we have not at this point scheduled a meeting. I have their phone numbers. I can get them if need be. But we haven't scheduled anything. Okay.